Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is the Runner's World podcast.
Hello and welcome to episode 8 of the Runner's World podcast. Each month we'll be bringing you the latest training advice, news and interviews from the wide world of running. I'm Rick Pearson, the Runner's World section editor, and I'm here with Ben Hobson, the digital editor. Ben, tell us what we got coming up on this episode.
This month we'll be speaking to Damien Hall about his fifth place at the Ultra Trail de Mont Blanc. Sophie Power will be talking about how she managed to complete said ultramarathon whilst breastfeeding. Author and runner Marcus Torgby will be talking about running in the Swedish wilderness. And we catch up with sprint star Dina Ashersmith to talk medals, motivation and chocolate buttons. Do you like a chocolate button, Rick?
Yeah, I'm up for it. I'm getting increasingly into chocolate, actually.
Oh, were you not really a chocolate man?
No, I wasn't. I was quite... I went through a few years of being a very disciplined eater, stroke a bit boring. So I would be like, no chocolate, I don't really like it.
Ice cream? Blah, blah.
Again, similar thing. But actually, I think that I was just denying myself these things in a kind of bid to be, in my mind, like fitter, I think it was.
Right.
So, and I think, I never think it got out of control or anything, but I just think actually I should have let myself have more treats, and now I am.
What's your confectionery of choice?
I'm a bit classic. I always like a Snickers.
Oh, that's a great shout.
Yeah, I love a Snickers.
Oh, yes.
I'm proud to say it.
Is it because it used to be called a marathon?
Oh, God.
Right.
Maybe. Maybe I thought subconsciously I was doing marathon training by eating Snickers.
That's what we all thought.
But I'm back on the chocolate. How about you?
Oh, unrelenting.
My one constant.
I have to go the other way and like have time off of it.
Right.
Yeah, because if it's there, I'll just eat it.
Well, apart from eating chocolate, Ben, what else have you been up to?
That's it. So I recently had an MRI on my knee.
Okay.
To get to the bottom of an ongoing issue.
And what's the diagnosis?
Oh, there's something to do with my meniscus. It's one of these things. But I can run, so that's fine. I've still been running. Okay. We had a particularly joyful session.
We did a 15K of
If anyone wants to replicate this, feel free. It was a 10-minute warm-up.
10-minute warm-up.
And then an hour of 3 minutes on at threshold, pretty much, and then 3 minutes off at sort of like a steady recovery. You can just do that for an hour.
It started off being
jovial. We were like, ha-ha, this is brilliant.
And then it got really hard, and there was no more talk after rep 7.
Yeah, exactly. What about you?
So I run-hiked, or like I guess you'd call it fast-packing. Ooh. If you were from the States, fast-packing.
Right.
Across the North Downs Way. So I did 37 miles to celebrate my best mate George's 37th birthday.
Fun.
So it's kind of like this run-your-age thing. And I think it's a tradition that we will only do for a few more years because I just can't see us being 65 and being like, hey,
cool,
man.
Here we go.
65 miles. Here we go. Bring your bus pass. Also took part in the Rye Ancient Trails race, which is organised by Sam Murphy, who...
Fantastic columnist.
Yeah, our columnist. It was brilliant. There was a 15K and a 30K, and being heroic, I chose a 15K.
Well done. Yeah, and we also must note, Kerry did the 30K.
Kerry did the 30K.
And said it was extra better.
Yeah. I saw him at the end. I'm not sure he was in the best state, but fair play to Kerry for doing it. I mean, he did run twice as far as me, so...
Yeah, it's true.
Fair enough. Yeah. Right, should we get on with the episode, then?
Yeah, sure.
This is the Runner's World podcast.
The Ultra Trail de Mont Blanc is widely regarded as one of the world's toughest races. Starting and finishing in Chamonix, France, it involves 106 miles of running and 31,000 foot of elevation. It attracts the world's best mountain runners, with this year's lineup widely regarded as one of the finest ever assembled. Yet among the 20-something full-time athletes making up the top 10, there was another man, Damien Hall, a 42-year-old freelance writer who lives nowhere near any mountains and only started running aged 34. Damien, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
First of all, a ginormous congratulations on finishing fifth at the UTMB. Did that exceed all of your expectations?
Yeah, I think it's still kind of sinking in. Yeah, my aim, so I was 12th the year before, and although that, you know, I was really pleased with that. Retrospectively, I think I was also quite frustrated because I'd sneaked into the 10th place quite near the end, but then I'd really taken my sort of eye off the ball and got into a bit of a funk and let slip two places. So I'd come away from the race thinking, 12th, that's pretty good, but it's not as good as it could have been. So all year I've been obsessing over it and just trying to improve, but I wouldn't have expected to be fifth. But it has to be said that, you know, quite a few, there were some vicious bees and wasps around. I don't know if you've heard the full story,
but
yes. So there were more DNFs from the front end than the year before, although it wasn't an uncommon amount of DNFs, to be honest. But I do owe a debt of gratitude to whatever.
The bee who stung Killian, was it?
Yeah, I'm very grateful to that bee. Yeah. So thank you, bee, wherever you are.
Well, unlike Killian and a lot of the front end of the field, you're not a full-time athlete, David. You don't live anywhere near the mountains either. Although you've managed to absolutely mix it with these people and finish fifth. What do you do to compensate for those, what would seem like disadvantages, I guess?
My good friends, Matt and Ellie from Summit Fever Media, are making a little film of UTMB, and they've called it Underdog. And I'm probably boring people by yabbering on about my disadvantages, but I got a family as well, which a lot of these guys don't have. I'm 42 now. My best marathon is sort of 2:38, which, you know, in a running club is okay, but some of these guys can run 2:20 marathons. Mm. So, and the other disadvantages you mentioned. So I guess what I can do is I am self-employed. I'm a journalist like you guys, although not to your high standards. But I'm able to. I can't really go do big miles at the weekend, but maybe I can take a day off in the week. You know, I'm my boss, so I can let myself have a day off.
Yeah.
And I go to the Brecon Beacons. Even there, though, the climbs are maybe 400 metres, whereas in UTMB, they'll be 8, 9 to 1,000 metres. But if you go up and down it several times, you know. So Brecon Beacons, and I can be a bit more flexible in the week than some people. And then also, I mean, I did go out this year and recce the course. I mean, I've done the race four times now, but so I knew it. But just to condition those legs, those sort of feeble British, southern British legs, to actually go out there and run the course over 3 days, which I did with three friends who all had a good race as well. I think that was a key sort of game changer for me.
So what is, in your opinion, what is the key to success at UTMB?
I think, actually, I mean, some people who have done the race joke that it's a hiking race, and you will spend many hours. Obviously, it takes longer to go up a hill than down it, so you might spend an hour and a half getting up a mountain, just 20 or 30 minutes going down it. So that's going to be hiking. It's just too steep to walk a lot of it, so you need to practice that hiking. And I think it's key not to think of it as a walk. You know, you're not on a Sunday afternoon ramble with your flask of tea and your crossword to stop off and do, sort of thing. You've got to practice it, hike efficiently, use poles or cheat sticks, as a lot of Britons call them. You really need to get good at that and get good technique. I've worked with Shane Benzie from Running Reborn on both running and sort of hiking. And that, to me, that's probably the key thing. And then for British people, the downhills, after a while, they really, really hurt. So it's getting those legs strong enough that your quads aren't super sore, I suppose, by the end of the race, because that can slow you down and make you cry sometimes.
Can we talk about the cheat sticks? Because I know that there's... Is there a school of thought, particularly in the kind of the US ultra-runners, who don't tend to use the cheat sticks, or I should be calling them trekking poles? But it seems that if you want to do well at UTMB, it's only stubbornness that would stop you using those trekking poles, isn't it?
Yeah, that's my view. I think people who don't take them are shooting themselves in the foot, really, or stabbing themselves with a pole in the foot. to me, it's almost foolish not to. But at the same time, like, I know, say, a really good ultra runner who lives in London, and he can't really, although he does quite well out there, he doesn't use poles because he can't really practice with them in London. So I think if you're not used to using them, it probably isn't sensible to grab them the day before and go, right, how do we do this? And you get really sore arms from doing that, actually, and tennis elbow and stuff. But so I think, yeah, I think it's a really good skill. Some of the US races aren't necessarily as sort of up and down. And the ultra running culture is quite interesting in the US. Like, a lot of their races, they might have a pacer, which isn't really a thing in Europe and Britain at all. But yeah, to me, the poles is a really sensible thing. But the only downside is they never look quite as cool in photographs. You never look quite as heroic. So the idea is you need to tuck them away as quickly as possible when there's a cameraman around.
I mean, going back to creating success, and you started talking about 12th and the fact that you were in 10th, and it was kind of a bit of a, not a disappointment, but shall we say it's a little niggle that kept on niggling.
Yeah.
So how do you the sort of mental side of it then, when you've come away from a race and you've got this feeling that actually, you know what, I can do better?
Well, yeah, I mean, so I've done the race four times now, four consecutive years, and each year I've come away with this amazing, wonderful, euphoric feeling, this wave of goodwill, both online and the people in Chamonix. The crowds are just so generous, but always this nagging feeling of I could have done better, whether it's something in training or in the race or both. So I had enough cause, I think, to think, well, I think the mistake I made the previous year was just not getting enough calories in towards the end of the race, because you're running for over 20 hours and you start to go off food, much as I love shoving the chocolate and cake in there. After a while, your mouth doesn't really want it and it's full of sugar and it's all pretty disgusting, and you can go off food. So you have to be more smarter with planning some savoury stuff and different types of, and liquid calories is a clever one, you know. Put stuff in your drinks. I had chocolate milk, smoothies,
right.
Mountain fuel drink. So I knew, I felt that if I trained just a bit better, but also if I was smarter with my nutrition this time, then I'd have more chance, I suppose.
You've kind of obsessed on this race, Dave, hasn't it? This has been a thing, yeah. A kind of real project for you.
Yeah.
And obviously, that's really paid off. What do your kind of friends and family make of the UTMB? Do they think it's fantastic, or they think, oh, finally, he's got top five, it's time to move on?
Definitely my family are probably quite bored of it. So the last two summers, the previous years, it's been a family holiday. I say that with speech quotes around it, because my wife says I'm not, you know, mentally there for the holiday and I'm useless afterwards. And in my household, if I mention UTMB, both my children go, UTMB, UTMB, which means, you know, shut up about UTMB, we're bored of it. So, yeah, definitely my family are quite pleased. I have promised them that I'm not doing UTMB next year. Friends, I don't know, I have sacrificed. Yeah, I mean, I've made sacrifices this year. I have sacrificed friendships. I haven't been social at all, really, with friends. And I'm hoping in the next few months to make up for that. I've missed weddings, missed my cousin's wedding to be there. I missed my good friend's wedding the other year. I missed my dad's 70th birthday this year for a race. Thank you for not having much obvious judgment in your eyes. I've made sacrifices that I hope to sort of make up for now, because it takes that to, you know, to be that high up in the field. It takes that level of commitment, I think.
For sure. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, yeah, the people that you're racing against are making those kind of sacrifices, aren't they?
Day in,
the
day
guy
out.
In fourth and third and sixth is making similar
choices. Yeah, well, most of those are full-time athletes. And I know definitely for a fact that the guys in second and third, who I know a little bit, they were both out there for a month before the race.
Wow.
Living there, you know, as far as I know, they don't have families. They're a bit younger. It's easier for them. But they were there, you know, a full month of training there beforehand. That's the sort of thing they were doing.
Yeah.
So it's difficult for me to compete, but yeah, I don't know. Getting closer.
Well, you did a bloody good job. First Brit, fifth, yeah, overall. It's absolutely incredible.
I mean,
incredible,
it's genuinely amazing, the fact that you're not a full-time athlete. And also, what I found shocking, because I've just found this out, that despite a brief running career at cross-country when you were younger, you only started running again competitively when you were 34.
I did my first half marathon in 2011 and absolutely loved it. It was the Bath half.
What did you run, out of interest?
1:40.
Okay, so like decent first effort, but not like, oh my God, we have ourselves an athlete, you know.
No, I probably ran two, maybe three times a week for that. And all I had as a guide was my brother-in-law, hello James, he had run 1:48, that was his best time. Yeah, and that's my only guide. Yeah, yeah, of course. So I just wanted to comfortably beat 1:48.
Yeah, yeah.
And obviously I've improved a bit since then, but I'm still not that fast. I haven't done one for 2 or 3 years, but I'm at about 1:16 or something. So not, you know, and Mo Farah's not getting too worried about me at the moment.
But let's talk about, so what did you do then between cross-country being okay at school to 34? What was your focus instead?
Oh, I was obsessed with football. So, and I became, my first job was a football journalist. Yes, 20 odd years just playing football obsessively, probably 3 or 4 times a week, then going to games at the same time and working as a football journalist. I got a little bit bored in my mid-20s and went travelling. That was a very exciting period. I lived in Australia for a while, but even then it was playing football. But I got into long-distance hiking,
okay,
which I think is a lot more similar to ultra running than, you know we all know secretly that ultra runners do hike quite a bit. And really it's, you know, you're carrying a pack, you're getting some chafing in some uncomfortable areas, you're shoving chocolate in. So it's fairly similar to ultra running in a way, going up and down big lumps. And I think that really led me naturally to the ultra running. And that's actually helped me quite a lot as well, I think.
Do you hope that your example as someone who got into this a little bit older with a full-time job will inspire other people who might be mid-30s thinking about doing ultra marathons?
I hope so. It's a nice idea that that might happen. I do remember being very inspired by Steve Way and his story.
Yeah.
I don't know when he took it up, but of achieving greatness in his early 40s, you know, setting national records, and you know, he's a phenomenal runner. And I followed his journey quite closely. And in ultra running, you can be a bit older. I think speed isn't such a thing, and also the mental side of it, it becomes huge. So it's good to have a bit of life experience. You know, I haven't had many tough moments in my life really compared to a lot of people, but when it gets dark, you know, when it's dark, both literally because you're running through the night and it's dark, you know, you're mentally in a dark mood, you know, a bit of life experience and that mental side that maybe only comes on later, you know, in the middle ages of life, can be really helpful as well. So it is a sport for the slightly older
definitely.
Athletes, I think.
Yeah.
In terms of motivational figureheads, I think it's important to mention your support crew.
Definitely. Yes.
Nikki. Just in the fact that she is phenomenal as an athlete and holds many, many records. So how much did that help you when you were out there?
She's huge. And there's definitely two different ways in which she helps. One is Nikki Spinks being such a sort of fell running legend. And if I come into a checkpoint, she's standing there, there's no way I'm going to whinge about, you know, a sore toenail or a, you know, a slight chafe somewhere. Because it's like, there's Nikki Spinks. She, you know, she runs for hours in the mountains and sets records that men don't, you know, that men don't match. So you've got that whole motivational side to it. But also she takes the job incredibly seriously. And I was on the phone to her 2 months beforehand chatting about something else entirely. And she said, right, I've been thinking about you, Tim B. I've been thinking what I need to do for you. How about these ideas? You know, she was so on it. She was obsessing over it as much, if not more, than me. And it was about, this time it was about getting the nutrition right. And, you know, the idea was she'd bully me into making sure, have you definitely eaten enough in the last 2 hours, you know? But she came up with ideas, and she's famous for her baked beans and rice puddings, which she hasn't quite sort of turned me on to yet, but they were there. She said, by the way, I've brought a few, you know, a few from my own race, my race bag, which I haven't quite, yeah, no, I haven't been converted to those, but no, she's a wonderful help.
Yeah, but... How did you meet Nikki Spinks to start off with?
It's kind of through. We're both sponsored by Innovate. It's mostly through that, actually. I'm trying to think when the first time, but as a journalist, I have interviewed her a couple of times when she's done amazing things. I think it probably started off like that, and then we've been met at sort of Innovate sort of get-togethers. And I think last year she was just going to be out there anyway, helping them on the stand. There's a big running expo. And I don't know if she had volunteered or, like, I wouldn't have the courage to ask, could I have Nikki Spinks on my side? But maybe she'd volunteered, I think. I really not sure I would have, you know, I don't think I'd be fifth without her. I mean, I would have got round, but I'm not sure I would be that high on the field. So I'm really grateful. I did send her some flowers afterwards. I don't know really if she's a flowers type of woman, but she said, you know, she seemed to be grateful.
Yeah, you know, classy gesture. You weren't the only British success, obviously, at the UTMB and across those races. What do you think of the state of British ultra running at the minute?
Oh, it's an exciting time, and I know on the same show you've got Sophie Power, who's got that incredible story, and she's just phenomenal. And I am totally in awe of people like her who are taking maybe twice the time or so many more hours to get round. And I don't know how to say it without it sounding a bit patronising, but you know they go through so much more than I do, and I'm in awe of those people. It was a very good year at UTMB for Brits. Like with Beth Pascal was fourth in the women's race, which is the highest finish for a British female since I think 2012 when Lizzie Hawker used to win and then Tom Evans winning CCC. I think that's the first British win at CCC, which is getting a very competitive race now. You know, there are other good runners around. I mean, on the global stage we're behind usually the Americans, the Spanish and the French, but signs are we're maybe slowly catching them up.
That's great. Well, Damien, thanks very, very much for coming on the Runner's World podcast. It was great to hear a little bit more about UTMB journey. I'd like to ask you what your plans are next. Do you have any other goals?
It's a bit of a rest for a couple of months now. I've done things like I sort of didn't drink for 3 months beforehand and stuff, so I've been, you know, making up for that.
Get yourself a beer in here.
Maybe I will.
Yeah.
Catching up with friends, like I say, and trying to repay the debt to my wife of sort of childcare credits. There's some quite advanced talks of a little winter adventure, maybe with one of the runners I've mentioned, and with my friends Summit Fever Media. I can't say too much yet, but maybe in December, somewhere in Britain, Northern Britain.
Right.
It would be a sort of snowy and dark adventure somewhere. And next year, my dream is to run a sort of Western States, which is the oldest trail 100 miler in the world, I think, but it's over in America. It's difficult to get into, but there are several doors I can bang on, which I'll be banging on.
I finished
fifth at the UTMB.
Just like that kind of thing. Yeah. I'm hoping to get into that, but yeah, it's all good.
Well, that sounds great. Well, thanks again for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me. Cheers.
This is the Runner's World podcast.
Sticking with the Ultra Trail de Mont Blanc for a moment, slightly further back in the field than Damien, another remarkable story was emerging. British ultra runner Sophie Powell was running the race while stopping to breastfeed her three-month-old baby, Cormac. We caught up with Sophie to hear more about her remarkable achievement and why she thinks it's time we updated the dialogue around pregnant women and new mums. So Sophie, many congratulations on finishing the UTMB. Obviously, you've hit the headlines for completing the race while also breastfeeding your three-month-old son, Cormac. I just wondered, what was the motivation for you to attempt the race in the first place?
So, I mean, UTMB has been a bucket list race for me for many years. And finally, I had the points and the ballot place in 2014. But I fell pregnant with my first son, Danica, and they refused to let me defer the entry for another year. And this was the next time I got a place. An automatic place because I'd missed out on the ballot so many times. And I never really thought about finishing the race. It was very much, I have this place. I'm going to try and be on the start line, try and experience it, take the family out for a week for holiday. But actually, training went really well through pregnancy. I recovered really quickly. And we thought, let's just try and get to Courmayeur.
I think it's important. I mean, people saw the story and they were probably like the sensationalised sort of elements of it in the picture, which obviously speaks volumes. But I think it's important to mention that you're a well-practiced ultra runner. It's like, it's not, you didn't just roll up to the start line and decide to do it.
No, absolutely not. And I think kind of people see a 106-mile run as a run, and very much UTMB, unless you're Damien Hall, it's a long, long hike. And that's a very different pressure on the body. I weight change through pregnancy, my tricep dips, pull up for the arms, quads, which take a bashing on the course. And I went around really gently, and you can do that. But certainly you can't go from childbirth to UTMB in 3 months with no previous experience.
But it's fair to say, though, Sophie, that you think that some of the messaging around the levels of exercise or strength training that pregnant women or recent mums should do is maybe due an update. Do you think that we're overcautious when we speak to pregnant women and mums about the kind of exercising they should be doing?
I think we are, and I think that's because everything is seen as a risk. But I think the risk in that is that everyone is told to sit down and put their feet up, and that's actually probably more unhealthy for you, certainly in terms of going through childbirth and recovering afterwards. I think for me the main thing is, you know when something's wrong for your body, you know inside yourself, and I took away exercises as I couldn't do them anymore or adjust to them and just really listened to my body, and the same with the recovery.
So you mentioned the tricep dips and the pull-ups, and I think if anyone has seen your Instagram account, they will have seen the video evidence of you working out with a considerable bump. What was it like to keep fit during pregnancy for you, and what was the actual training that you did?
So I stopped running with Cormac at 5 months. I stopped running with Danica, my first, at 7.5, and actually I had a really quite difficult recovery after that. It was a bit too long for me. So I took away all the impact at 5 months and went straight to the stair mill, which is great replication of UTMB, just climbing stairs kind of minute after minute. And that was my cardio along with long hikes and also spin class and swimming. And in the weights, it was very much making sure I stayed strong and focusing on an all-round strength that I needed for the race. So actually, I kept my weight fairly consistent through pregnancy. I guess I used to do pull-ups with a weight belt on, and then I had a bump instead. but I stayed training all the way up until I gave birth, and it felt natural to do that.
So just back to the race aspect. I mean, what were some of the practical considerations of racing? Because obviously, you couldn't just concentrate on getting yourself to the finish line. You had other considerations on the day as well, right?
Very much so. I mean, being a breastfeeding mum added a whole new spanner in the works. So it was long as I'd been away from Cormac, actually. And we knew we couldn't get a breast pump to me or the baby to me until Courmayeur. So the first 16 hours, new mums are going to be having this in their heads with the pain and just trying to hand express at aid stations. But then after then, having Cormac at Courmayeur, having the pump, And then my husband then was able to go through the next night with me and meet me at 3 checkpoints with the pump. So I knew I had to do that. I think the other consideration was making sure I kept the milk supply up. So I'm kind of feeding 2 people. And as you know, it's hard enough on an archer to feed yourself. So I had to go around the course so slowly. Really, I wasn't fat adapted doing breastfeeding and eating 24 hours a day. So trying to keep down 300 calories an hour for the first 12 hours and then as much as possible afterwards, you have to go slow, you have to hike, you have to stay very much within your limits. It's a completely different way of racing than I've done before, but that's what I had to do to get around the course.
300 calories, what was that each time? What was your main food source?
I love Tia Charge bars, the flapjacks. It's 400 calories and I know I can get down one of those pretty quickly. My husband had avocado sandwiches, which were always brilliant. But very much kind of looking at the aid station table and I just stand there and see what can I eat and then supplement it with chocolate biscuits mainly and wine gums and Haribo and all those really healthy foods.
Oh, that sounds great.
I've never been one for gels, but there are a lot of chocolate biscuits that fueled me around that race.
Obviously, Sophie, you're a very busy person. You know, your mum, a wife, you run a business, I believe, as well. A lot of people think about ultramarathons and think, well, if I had time to run 70 miles a week, then I too could run an ultramarathon. But that's not been the way that you've trained for it, has it? Your mileage is much more minimal than that, I understand.
Absolutely. I mean, I did Spartathlon in 2016, which is a far kind of tougher race, kind of, I would think, kind of fitness-wise. And I did that on 35 to 40 miles a week. 40 miles is probably the max with a few races thrown in, plus weight training. And that's what works for me. As you say, you run a business. I don't have enough hours to do those mileage. And I think kind of people think of ultras as marathon plus, plus, plus.
Mm.
And actually, a lot of ultras are really much more accessible than that. 30 miles, 50 miles on trail, the speed you're going, the breaks you're having, you can do that on easily less than marathon training if you're not out there to win. If you're out there to win, and I was on a panel with Tom Evans earlier this week, and he trains 45 hours a week, it's very different. But I think ultras are much more accessible on a lower volume of training than people really think.
I think we've seen a few videos of you crossing the finish line with family. How did it feel to reach that finish line, especially as you started not thinking that you would finish it and just to take part? So how did it feel to cross that line?
It was amazing. I think I was very much going around. The thing that kept me going was the fact that I don't think three-year-olds understand DNF. and he'd been waiting 2 days to cross the finish line with me, and he'd seen all the other races, the OCC, the CCC, the people coming through with their kids, and he's like, that's going to be really my mummy. So I didn't really have a choice. but I think seeing the look on his face at the finish, running through Chamonix, picking up Cormac, it was all about him. I didn't even think about the fact I'd been out for 43 and a half hours on 20 minutes sleep. It was just so wonderful to see how happy it made him.
And what's the reaction been like from the kind of running community at large, Sophie? Has it been very positive, or have people been negative about what you managed to achieve?
It's been insanely positive. I mean, I never asked for the picture to go viral or for so many people to see it. I actually thought it would just be another UTMB picture. But what it's done, certainly kind of a lot of women runners, ultra runners, but just mums, I think it speaks a lot to the juggling that we do. And we just get on with things. And also the need that we really... It's healthy to take a little bit of time for yourself as a person rather than just being mum, especially in those first few months. So I've had thousands and thousands of comments and questions from them, and it's been really wonderful to have.
Yeah, I mean the reaction was overwhelming. I think in regards to sort of people noting what you'd achieved and taking it as a real motivational thing for them to do some more running and to get involved. And I think most people would probably want to know what you're doing next.
It's funny because I don't think I've even signed up for anything. I think certainly I need to continue the recovery. I wouldn't be running I'm only 3 months after. I wouldn't even be running a tarmac marathon now for me, the way my body needs to still heal. I'm looking forward to getting back with my coach, Eddie Sutton, and getting some speed together. She's only ever trained me from pregnancy, so we've been on the treadmill hiking an incline, which has been very boring. Getting some speed back, I think I definitely have my eye on Tourgeon next year. I've been tracking everyone all week, but certainly some shorter mountain races. We'll see what happens.
Well, Sophie, thank you very, very much for making the time to speak with us for the Runner's World podcast, and congratulations again on an amazing achievement at the UTMB.
Perfect. Thank you very much.
All right, thanks a lot, Sophie. Okay, cheers.
Thanks. Bye.
This is the Runner's World podcast.
So here's an interesting study, Ben, for a self-effacing man such as yourself. Modesty, it seems, is no good for your health. Bask in your victories and enjoy the life-lengthening benefits. According to new research from the University of Toronto, celebrating success made winners more resilient to the life stresses that cause body and mind to age faster.
Wow.
So get out there and say you're a good runner. Let me hear you say it.
I'm such a good runner.
Mean it!
Yeah! No, I would 100%. You can. That makes total sense to me. Like, I mean, that's of course if you're the self-perpetuating power of self-congratulation. You see what I mean?
Yeah, I see what you mean. I think there's a balance with that, isn't it? You know, be proud of yourself, but no one wants someone to.
We're not like the humble brag. Is not. We're not talking about that.
Me?
Oh God, I just. Sorry to mention it, guys. I managed to run another PB at the weekend. No, I mean. But I think that celebrating your achievements is very important for runners. Mm. Yeah, absolutely. Because if you think about it, running for the majority of the time is probably the opposite. It's consistently hard, and it's probably quite a lot of failure before success. Mm. So, you know, I think it's important to make a note of the big ones.
Yeah, agreed. Agreed. Yeah. So let us know. podcast@runnersworld.co.uk. What have you achieved recently? Have you run a PB? Have you managed to run a marathon for the first time? Let us know. Don't be modest. You'll live longer.
Marcus Torgeby was just 20 years old when he headed off into the remote Swedish forest to live as a recluse and dedicate himself to his one true passion, running. For 4 years, he lived in a tent in the wilderness, braving the hard Swedish winters. His book, The Runner, is a bestseller in his homeland and a powerful exploration of running and personal well-being. We caught up with him over the phone. Age 20, most people are probably studying, working, or going out partying, and you decided to head into the Swedish wilderness. Why?
I had no direction in life, so I just thought if I put myself in a situation where everything is black and white, maybe I can find my own head, you know. So that's why I took the decision to leave the society and move out in the forest.
What were some of the day-to-day challenges of living in remote northern Sweden?
Yeah, so depends on which time of year, but in the winter time it was just when it's really, really cold. You know, when you pee, before the pee hit the ground, it's frozen.
So wow.
Then you must focus. So just keep myself warm. You know, I had my toes and my fingers very, very often white because of the cold. So it was quite a struggle in the winter.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com. Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
In the time, and in the spring and in the summertime, it was no problem. More then it was a little bit more problem in the head, you know, because then it's easy to live outside and then all the thoughts come, you understand?
Yeah.
So in the winter time when it's a bit tough to live outside, then you have like focus on just the basic needs, and then when the summer comes, the struggle is not so hard, but then it's a little bit tougher for the head because a lot of thought.
Back to the cold and surviving that. I mean, how much kit did you have to have with you? How many clothes and gloves and those sorts of things?
Yeah, always two gloves in the winter times. And then you have like long johns and like maybe a big jacket and some underwear, you know, and then you must keep yourself running. You cannot sit still in the winter, so I walk and skied a lot, and then when I came back to the teepee, I start a fire, and then, you know, so you must use the body to work with it, and then you will get the warmth, so it was no problem, but of course a little bit tough also.
Yeah, no, it sounds tough. I mean, as well as keeping you warm, what else did running offer you during that period?
You know, in the beginning, I was restless because, you know, I have nothing to do. So then when I just go out for a run, it feels a little bit more calm in the head. So my running was like a big thing for me, because it was something that I did every day. And when I did that, I felt like great. I just run one time a day or two times. And when I did that, life was perfect.
Sounds good, actually. Did you have any interesting or scary encounters with any wildlife? I'm pretty sure that northern Sweden has some interesting animals on that you can probably run into.
Yeah, but you know, now this time of year it's the moose hunt, so then the moose are quite aggressive. So if I was out for a long run and so I must just take it. So no bears and no wolves, that were no problem. But sometimes, so September, October every year, the moose hunt was a little bit take care of myself in that period, because it was a lot of hunters and also a lot of aggressive moose.
Could you outrun a moose, Marcus? You're quick.
No. You know, they run really, really fast.
Yeah. You were doing this on your own, Marcus, but do you wish that more people would seek out wilderness and wild places in their life?
Yeah, I think so, because, you know, in the society we're living today, I think it's a great society, you know, we have a lot of opportunities, but I think it's also easy to get lost in the head, because, you know, it's so much information, and sometimes in life I think it can be important to put yourself in a very black and white situation, because then it's easy to feel what's important for real, you know, to feel you are really hungry, then you eat, you know, it's perfect. You are really cold, and then you start a fire, then you are perfect happy, you know. To feel that the black and white kind of life, I think that's really, really important.
Yeah, going back to basics.
Yeah, I think so, because, you know, in Sweden now, those days, in a way, we have everything, but still a lot of people that feel sad, you know, in the head, and I think it's because, you know, you have everything. And when you have everything, you are always satisfied. I think it's easy to lost the direction.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think. So I think it's important to live a little bit more black and white.
In your book, you mentioned your mother and her fighting MS.
Yeah.
Did you see her physical struggles and decline? Did that motivate you to embrace your own physical needs?
Maybe, but, you know, for me, it was really tough back home. You know, my mother was 28 years old when she became ill. And, you know, 2 years later, she sat in a wheelchair and she's struggling a lot. Mm. And, of course, it was like a big worry, back home, because we didn't know how long will she survive. So when I run, you know, I was just in my own head. So in some way, I think my running was an escape. You know, life felt the, you know, clear and easy when I ran. So yeah, I did that.
And you were a very good runner, Marcus. I mean, you were a very decent middle distance runner.
Yeah.
What are your memories of that period, and why did you kind of sort of step away from the track?
You know, in the beginning, you know, my only ambition were to push hard and to compete and to win. But, you know, I had a really hard trainer, and he pushed me really, really hard. So, you know, I get like a big injury, and then I couldn't run anymore. And then I moved out in the forest, and then I start to run from a different direction. You know, I realized that, okay, I will not be Olympian, but still I like to run, and, you know, to be just by myself and to run over the hills and just by myself in the forest, I felt it was a good feeling. So yeah, I find a different way of running, and I am really glad that I find that way, because I see a lot of people today that their only ambition with their running is to compete, and I can understand that. But, you know, running can be a much more, not just that. It can be, you know, a way to, you know, the food tastes better, and you sleep better, and so I think to see you running a little bit more, what you say, wider, not just from one direction.
What do you think about the increasing role that technology and social media are playing in running?
You know, running is very, very simple, and I think that is one of the best things with running. It's just you and a couple of shorts and some shoes, you know. Then you just can go out. And today, I think many people, they think that they must have all these different, you know, technology things. And of course, you can have it, but it's no need for them. Just go out and feel your heart. I try to run in that way anyway. And of course, sometimes when I have a little bit more ambitious to try to compete, I have my watch and try to focus in intervals and things like that. And then you can have some, you know, technical things. But most of the time, I think it's enough with just one pair of shoes and, you know, a single and a couple of shorts, and then you'll just go.
In the book, and just now, you mentioned that you had this kind of sense of restlessness when you were growing up. What advice would you give to anyone else who might be feeling anxious?
You know, you must just be in that feeling. You know, I was restless a lot in the beginning in the forest, and I just realized I put myself on a tree stump, and then I sit there for 3 months, then it disappeared. So I think if you want to take the restless feeling away, you cannot do a lot of things, because then the restless feeling will not go away. So you must just take it easy and to fight that feeling, and maybe it takes 1 or 2 months, and then you are free. So my advice is, don't do anything, just be in that feeling, and then it will disappear.
You also visited Tanzania to run with some of the best East Africans. What did you learn from that experience?
You know, I learned that, you know, they always run with the body. They push hard, but not too hard. So they build like a mental strength, because they were, do you say self-confidence?
So
they always run at the right levels. So they have like a great confidence in the body and also in the head. So maybe that was the thing that I learned from the Tanzanian guys, you know.
I guess you mentioned in the book as well, during that period, you became a little obsessed about your weight, and it might be what some people describe as sort of heading towards kind of eating disorder territory. What have you learned through that experience?
You know, when you do something that you really love to do, and you push really hard, it's easy to overdo it, but you don't see it come because, you know, day after day you push a little bit harder, you know, and then 6 months later you are, you know, you're far away. So it's a little bit hard to explain, but, you know, the change is so little day by day, and then, you know, a couple of months later you have like a big problem in the head. Yeah. So it was like that for me. I had really big problem with the eating, you know. I realized that I must eat, but I couldn't because it was problem in the head.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
It was so I can really understand those that have that kind of struggles, because I see a lot of runners, they have that kind of struggles, you know. You know, because if you're going to run fast, you must be light. Yeah. So if you lose some weight, you run faster, but it's also easy to overdo it, and then you have like big problem. And for me, you know, I could, so it was when I came back home and just moved out in the forest again, then I find a way to heal myself mentally, because, you know, I pushed really, really hard, and I had really, really big problems with eating after the period in Tanzania.
When you're back running in the forest and outside, are you an advocate of minimalist running? Do you run like with a low profile shoe, or do you like a big running shoe? What's your kind of kit do you like using?
No, I like to feel the ground, you know. So I try to run with, you know, not like bare, so quite thin shoes. I like that when I feel the ground. Then I think my feet take a good decision, and so I try to run with, you know, flat.
Yeah, I think that's your track yeah. Past is still there, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. You know, to feel, you have to feel the ground and to feel the legs. I like that feeling.
Yeah.
Do you see running, Marcus, as an expression of freedom? Does it offer you that feeling?
Yes, 100%. You know, I'm 42 years old today, but I run every
day. Happy birthday. And
yes, thank you. You know, but still, I love to run every day, you know. Of course, sometimes I try to focus a little bit more if I go to compete in some way, but, you know, most of the time I just go out and to run by myself, and that feeling, you know, it feels perfect inside. And sometimes when I work a lot, you know, it's a little bit, I feel maybe a little bit stressed. Then I go out for a long run, then it's okay again. So I think the running keeps, as it helps me to be on the, what you say, the thin road, you understand?
Yeah,
so,
straight and narrow.
If I don't run, yeah, it's easy to just go crazy, so that's why I'm still running, I think.
So do you think you've found a nice balance in life now, Marcus?
Yeah, I think so. But, you know, I have, you know, my mentality is to push, so of course sometimes I overdo it, but it's okay, you know. Life is like that. I think life is more circular. It's not like a highway. I think life is, sometimes you're sad, sometimes you're happy, sometimes you are hungry, and sometimes you have food in the stomach. Life is like that. It's no problem, you know. You must just give that feeling a hug. You know, I think today people are afraid of all the negative feelings because they think that something is wrong. But I think that's a part of being a human being.
Marcus, I think we can all take away something quite profound about taking ourselves away from everything now and again to find a truer meaning. I think it's a nice idea, and I think, and well done for doing it. And it's good to hear that you're enjoying life now on your birthday.
Yeah, thank you, man.
Thank you so much for joining us on the Runner's World podcast. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks,
cheers.
Marcus.
Thanks
cheers.
A lot.
Okay.
Bye.
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 For more from Runner's World,
head to runnersworld.co.uk.
So interesting to hear Marcus talk about that. I actually went on holiday recently to Sweden, and we went round some of the archipelago that I think is where near where Marcus grew up. And it is, I mean, that wasn't even northern Sweden, but it's very wild. And I kind of get a sense of what it must have been like just to sort of take himself away when he was 20.
I think we talk about, well, certainly we try to talk about mental health and running and the positives that it has. But I think to talk to someone whose story is solely like to remove themselves and just to run, to sort of recalibrate.
Yeah.
It's super interesting.
Yeah. I liked his idea, his advice about if you're feeling anxious, just to sort of sit with it, not to constantly try and run from that
feeling. Give that feeling a hug.
Yeah, that's what
I like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really nice.
I think he still lives in the kind of countryside with his family, but it's nice that I feel like there was a journey there and he's actually now got more of a sense of balance in his life. Running's still playing a part, but it's not this kind of all-consuming negative thing either.
No, it was really good.
Cool. Well, on the cover of the next issue of Runner's World is Team GB's Dina Asher-Smith, fresh from winning 3 golds at the European Championships. We managed to catch up with her to talk about how she got started and where she hopes to go next. The audio on the next clip isn't top-notch as it was recorded via Skype, but we hope you still find it an interesting listen. So, Dina Asher-Smith, welcome to the Runner's World podcast. It's absolutely great to be speaking with you, particularly on the back of your amazing performance at the European Championships. What were your expectations going into that tournament? Did you surpass them, or were you hoping to come away with all 3 golds?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me. And the Europeans was great fun, and it was very successful for me. Obviously, I went into it hoping that I could win the events that I'm in, but obviously when you're in that kind of championship, you never know what's going to happen. That's why we all love track and field, I guess. You might be a favourite, or you might be the fastest one going in, but you never quite know what's going to happen. So I definitely, winning all 3 golds was in my aims, it was my target, and I'm very happy to have done that. But in terms of the times that I ran and winning together with the relay team, that certainly surpassed my expectations.
Do you have any kind of mantras or like pre-racing kind of rituals that you do to make sure you're in that kind of right headspace?
I actually don't. I think for that, my coach and my physio are really, really brilliant because they help me make sure that I'm in the right mental headspace. They make sure that I'm calm and relaxed and happy, really. For me, I'm just kind of like a bubbly and excitable person. So if I want to be able to do well and if I want to be able to succeed on track, I just have to be relaxed and happy.
I'm sure your running is going to inspire lots of people, but I wondered about if you have a running hero who kind of inspired you.
Definitely, Alison Felix.
Right,
definitely.
Yeah.
I mean, it's nice to think that people swear by me, which is really cool. But Alison Felix, she is my absolute hero. Like, she's a living legend. I mean, there are so many legends in track. You've got obviously Usain, who's such a tyrant, and all those things. But Alison, she's won everything that you can win. I think she's the most decorated female track and field athlete ever. And she just does it all with such grace, and that's something that I think is really commendable and something that we can all learn from, irrespective of whether that's in running or just in life in general.
So I guess alongside, training as an elite athlete, you also got a history degree. Was it very difficult to kind of juggle those two things? Because, one of them sounds hard enough, yeah.
Definitely was. Everybody always asked me, did you find it hard? And the honest answer is, yeah, I definitely did. It was difficult because, I did do my history degree at King's College London, which everybody knows it is a rigorous degree. It's a rigorous education anyway, and that's why I wanted to go there, because I knew that I would get a really, really good standard of teaching. That, alongside trying to qualify for World Championships, various World Championships, and obviously the Olympic Games back when I was studying, it was hard, but I don't think anything that's worth having in life, anything that's worth having in life does come easily. You have to work for most things. I can't think of many people that haven't had to really apply themselves and haven't had to really work hard for something that they want.
I know that you were also the kit carrier on Super Saturday back in London 2012. I wonder how inspiring a night that was for you to see all those great British athletes winning gold medals.
It was such an amazing night. It was probably, anybody that was in the Olympic Stadium that night does say that the atmosphere was just incomparable. I mean, it's very, very hard to describe the atmosphere in words.
what the stadium was like that night. But yeah, the performances were inspiring. But actually, for me, what resonated with me more was the way that the crowd reacted to people, to Jess, to Greg, and those performances. Because, I mean, yeah, you see the incredible performances. They won gold at 2012. Like, that is the pinnacle of your career. It's everything you want. Like, to win gold medals at a home Olympics, that is every athlete's dream. But I think what was more powerful was when you kind of looked around, you saw people that didn't really know them, people that, well, not didn't really know them, but like, they weren't like little neighbours, they weren't like mums, uncles. They were a part of the general public that didn't have a close relationship to that close personal relationship to the athlete, but they were still so proud. And like, sometimes they were crying and they were screaming and they were just overjoyed to see them be successful.
I guess one of the athletes that won on that Super Saturday, Dina, was Jess Ennis-Hill, and I guess she was a sort of poster girl of that London Olympics. And I guess there are some people who'd be thinking that they'd like you to be the kind of, have a similar role for track and field. Is that something that you're aware of and comfortable with, or do you try to sort of resist that a bit?
It's something that I'm aware of. I'm comfortable with it, yeah. That's good because it comes with the territory. If anything, but whether or not, I think it's cool, it's nice, and it's very heartwarming to see that people think of me like that. But I always think the great thing about athletics is that you've got so many different personalities across so many disciplines, and that's why I love it, because 1 second you can have, me on the home straight running, and then in the next breath you've got Laura Muir running laps, having done her best to do and doing absolutely fantastically. You've got Pat doing 7 events over 2 days. You've got Morphe in the high jump. You've got so many brilliant personalities, and you've got so many different people that bring so many things to British track and field and world track and field in general, that feel like you can even kind of share it out. But but I am aware of what people are saying, and it's nice and it's heartwarming, and I kind of want to say thank you to them that they believe that, yeah, that's me.
I guess with all the increased attention, I guess, and expectation, how do you keep your feet on the ground? How do you stay grounded?
Well, to be fair, I'm not finding it too hard, if I'm being honest, because I haven't really noticed it too much in my day-to-day life. Like, my Instagram followers went up, but that's it, and that's not really, like, real life, is it? I'm still going, I'm training as normal, my friends are all coming around as normal, my friends are still laughing at me when I trip over my own feet and do silly things. Everything's very much the same. So for me, life hasn't really changed. I think that's a really good thing, because ultimately it gives me the time and to focus on what makes me kind of fast in the first place.
How do you unwind, Dina? What do you do when you're not running?
I love to travel. But travelling for track and field, travelling for races is very different to travelling for a pleasure, because when you're travelling for races, obviously you're less focused, you're get off the plane, hotel, track, train, sleep, train, and you race and you come home. So you don't really get to be a tourist. But when you get to do it on holiday, you get to kind of see the most beautiful scenery. You get to enjoy the cultures, cities and countries, which is really fascinating. That's what I like to do. Especially coming from a history background, I love to go to places where I'm like, oh my God, this happened. Like, how many years ago? Take a picture of me here. Or I'm standing there, Louis Armstrong stood. Oh my God. So yeah, I like to travel.
Do you ever do? I mean, I guess a lot of our readers, Dina, are more into long distance running. Are you interested in sort of slower, longer distance stuff? Do you ever do that stuff for fun or as part of training?
To be fair, I actually don't at all. Which I never run probably more than a 300 or even a 400 meters, and that's jogging, running fast, or otherwise. Simply because if you think about it, for me, it's kind of counterintuitive, because I spend how many weeks, I spend 48 weeks of my life, well, a year, 66 days a week, 48 weeks of the year, trying to make my feet turn over as quickly as possible, trying to get as much power to the floor and make my feet go as quickly as possible. But and then for me to kind of go and jog for long times, it kind of undoes that, if you get what I mean.
Yes, for sure.
It's kind of the opposite to what I want. So for me, doing long distance running isn't part of my training program. But I think when I get older and I move out of sprinting and I don't need to have my feet moving as fast, that's definitely something I do, because I feel like I'm not missing out, but everybody talks about how relaxing it is and how I know the Laura Waitman and Laura Muir, they always, when I get to in destinations and like to races, they always go on the most beautiful running trails. Mm. And like when they go to Oregon, they always talk about Puy's running trail, and I'm like, oh, I could walk it. Having a nice relaxing jog would be great, but unfortunately, it's not part of my training program.
You have to wait for after the career's over, I guess. But there's plenty of time.
Yeah, another 10 years.
Yeah. So in the meantime, how do you rate the state of British sprinting, both for men and women? Do you think we're in a good place, or do you think there's more improvement?
I'm a bit biased, aren't I?
Yeah, you are biased in your totally unbiased opinion.
Totally unbiased. And well, to be fair, there's always room for improvement. I'm one of those people that even if I was to go and win everything there is to win, I'd still be like, yeah, but you know, when I started, my right foot didn't come through quick enough. So blah blah blah. But I always think there's always room for improvement. Everybody could always do running faster. That's what we push for. That's what we train for. But right now, I think it's 10 out of 10 really healthy, because we've got so many people with just such good mentalities coming through and sprinting. They're young and they have good mentalities. And aside from performances, that's what's always the most important when we're young. Because if you're running, I don't know, 9.7 at 19, that you've got kind of a mentality of, this is me, I am the best, blah, 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 then you're unlikely to improve, because you haven't got the kind of the hunger and the need to and the determination to keep going to training and working hard. But sometimes, yeah, it's a mentality that are born. And I think that's the thing in British sprinting that is so special right now, is the fact that not only are, you know, the both across the men and the women talented, and they're young, so they've got a lot of time to progress and improve. But mentally, they're hungry and they're humble, which always makes me that every year you're going to come to winter training and give it your all and work even harder to be as fast as you can be. And that's something that will ultimately turn your performances into medal winning performances, whether that's with the relay or on an individual basis, because you will always keep working harder. You're never going to get complacent. And I think, yeah, British sprinting is in a good place. But I think it's the fact that people are hard workers. That's what makes it so special.
Could you tell us how you first got started into running? Was it something that you were immediately good at, or do you think you kind of it was something that took a little bit of a few years?
I actually got started through what you say, jogging. When I was younger, I was really sporty. So I used to swim, I used to do platform diving, I used to do dancing, both ballet and jazz. So I was just active. And at my primary school, there was a new running club.
Yeah.
And my friend said, oh, will you come to this new running club with me? And at first I was like, no, you're good. Like, running doesn't seem like it for me. Ironic. Running isn't really for me. I already do so many things, because besides sport, I was also playing the trumpet, like learning how to do French, all these things. And I was literally like, no, I haven't got busy. And she was like, if you come with me, I'll buy you my ice cream. I was like, yeah, okay, cool, I'll come then. I just went for the first session. I didn't really think much of it. And then I thought that was going to be like it, because I did my dues and I was going to get my ice cream. But then, because I went to quite a small primary school, by just turning up on the first day, that means we were automatically entered for the local cross-country competition, which then I was not there to leave by. I was like, this is not worth an ice cream. There was about 300-400 children in the Bromley Primary School cross-country at Crystal Palace. And I remember just running and running and running and running and running. And you know, well, you understand what I mean. You know, when you run for a long time, you get that taste of what you think is blood in your mouth?
Yeah.
Like, do you get that? Yeah, like, obviously the sprinter, I don't get that anymore, which is fabulous. But I remember I had that when I was like, I was 8 years old, and I was running and I was thinking, I'm going to die. So I stopped to talk to the marshal and I was like, look, I can taste blood in my mouth. I actually think that I'm dying. And then he was like, just keep going. And I was like, oh no, I'm going to die. And it's all outside my fault, like I told him. And I just kept running and running and running. And then I finished. And my mum came up to me. She was like hugging me and like, oh, you look so good. I didn't understand what was going on. But it turns out I came like fifth out of like 300-400 kids. So I was like, oh, I should do it right. And then obviously that means, unfortunately, I have to do it again.
Yeah.
I did it again, and obviously I think I won the next one, and then I won the one after. I came joint first the one after that. But then from doing cross country, I went to my local running club. I tried long jumps, and then I fell into sprinting, which was fabulous. I found out, hey, there's a thing that, because I'm a bit of a come on, let's go for it kind of person. Sprinting has that kind of aggression. It has that kind of confidence. You know, when you've got to stand the line and there's no pacing it, you have got to be ready or you're not. And so when the gun goes, you've got to give it your all. And that really resonated with me because that is the kind of thing. That's like my kind of personality. It's like, come on, let's go for it. That's me. Yeah, I was very happy that I fell into sprinting.
You mentioned the lure of the ice cream there. And I wonder if there is, do you have a kind of post-run treat that you allow yourself to kind of indulge in?
You know what? It's normally a post-season treat, which is, especially this year, my whole team has been so on it with me. They've been like, come on, you're in great shape. Push it through. Your team is going to be good. So every time I'm like, yeah, I had a PB. Can I have a cupcake? They're like, no. For me, you know what? My post-season treat is just everything. It's just everything I have ever wanted and craved. So that, for me, is ribs. It's mac and cheese. It's cakes. It is ice cream. It's everything. Honestly, it is absolutely everything. I've got a real craving for Cadbury's chocolate buttons right now. Like, they're my absolute favourite. You know those things when it's just, I think every year we all have different cravings. Last year it was sweet potato fries. Like, it was like everywhere with Chipotle mayonnaise and I couldn't have any. It was awful. Now I don't really need them anymore. I'm not craving that, but it's chocolate buttons, right? Every time I walk into a petrol station, I'm like, oh my word, there's more chocolate buttons. So I guess chocolate buttons for me, is the one right now. But I'm finished soon, so I'll be eating those. Just imagine me in off season lying on the beach with loads of Cadbury's chocolate buttons.
Rosina, thank you very, very much for speaking with us for the Runner's World podcast. It was absolutely amazing to hear about how you started off. Also, your love of Cadbury's chocolate buttons and plans for the future. So thanks very much for making the time to speak with us.
Oh, thank you.
For more from Runner's World, head to runnersworld.co.uk.
So that brings us to the end of this month's Runner's World podcast. I want to say a big thank you to our guests, Damien Hall, Sophie Power, Marcus Turgaby and Dina Asher-Smith, and to Scramble Studios in Soho, where this was recorded.
For more from Runner's World, why not visit our website, runnersworld.co.uk, where you'll find more news, reviews and interviews from the wide world of running.
If you like what you've heard, please subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and give us a rating. Thank you very much for listening and we'll see you next month.
The Runner's World podcast was recorded at Scramble Studios, Soho.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight. and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.